So, the evening of the first full day, we're still all here. It's good to see you all. So the title of this retreat was The Four Noble Truths, the Buddha's Way of Stress Reduction. So I'm going to look at the Four Noble Truths in that context, but I'm also going to kind of weave in some other things. There's so much to say in a short retreat like this, especially with so many people that are new to the practice and to retreats, that it was the challenge was to kind of decide which was the most important and which you'll hear another time. But the Four Noble Truths will be the basis of the talk. So that it's the first discourse or the first talk that the Buddha gave after his enlightenment, the first full talk, the first teaching. And it is said that it encompasses the entire path. If you understand the Four Noble Truths, you understand the Dharma, the suffering and the end of suffering, which is, if the Buddha was generally asked, you know, what he teaches, it was the truth of suffering and the path to the cessation of suffering. And the way it's formulated is, well, you probably got it, if you've studied the Buddha's teachings, you got that he likes lists, right? Okay, four of this, seven of that, like everything's in a list. So, of course, the Four Noble Truths have 12 insights associated with them. So each noble truth has three insights that you can think about it that way, and at three levels. And I find it really helpful to kind of approach it from those three levels, because it points to what investigation is. And I used that word yesterday, the non-cognitive kind of realizing. So the first level is wise reflecting. And here we're actually using our discursive thinking. So you're reading it, you're going, okay, I understand that. Now that makes sense logically. Okay, I kind of understand that. You reflect on a bit. Yeah, that sort of holds together. Maybe I'll read this and see if that helps me understand it a little better, intellectually, really. And that's so the Buddha wasn't against us thinking. It was just kind of the first level. So that's the first, all of those noble truths you can kind of understand at that level, and you can understand them from that level, from listening to a talk like this, from reading a book about it, and so on. The second level is, okay, I think I've got the gist of it. Let's see if it holds true in my experience. So you go out and you kind of test it. Let's test it. Test the truth of this based on, you know, what arises in my life. And that's so the second insight is at that kind of level. And that's really what we've been practicing a lot here. I mean, in the meditation, it's this laboratory for practicing to see the way things are. And the third insight, or the third phase or level, is knowing that you know. So you know it deep in your bones. You've confirmed it in your practice, and it becomes part of how you live your life. Some people use the word, it's integrated into your life, but I like to think of it, it's not something that comes, it just is. It's just, it's known. Somebody tells you otherwise, somebody could show you a big study that proves otherwise, you just kind of know. That's a study of it. I know in my bones, I know at a deeper level the truth of this. So it's this knowing and living from it. And this is a very important insight, because people can come on retreats and have all kinds of insights and then just kind of park them away and don't actually then look at how that shifts how they live. And if you just go to, if you remember, at one point I had kind of like two personas. I had the meditator persona, go on retreats, and I realized certain things, and then I had my back at work regular persona, where all of it just seemed to, you know, I'd forget about it. And then I'd go back on retreat and I'd go, this is like deja vu. Didn't I have like all this? And it wasn't until a teacher pointed out, yeah, well, you got to kind of live it in between the retreats, or you just kind of repeat each time. So hopefully by pointing that out, you can avoid an extra decade of of practice. So the integrating part is very important, and perhaps what is left out, surprisingly, from what I find, from my personal experience. So the four truths are, truth one is suffering is to be fully understood. These are the things you realize. Suffering is understood. The second is that craving is to be fully abandoned. The third is that the unconditioned reality or nirvana is fully realized. And the fourth is the Noble Eightfold Path is fully developed. So these are the really the tasks, in a sense, of each noble truth. And I'll go through each of those. In fact, you know what? This is what we're really looking at when I talk about looking at how we can respond rather than react to what arises in our lives. We're really looking at these truths. The willingness to open to discomfort, to pain, rather than shutting down from it. This is based on the teachings of the Four Noble Truths. And seeing these difficulties as an opportunity to practice, as almost like as a gift for our spiritual growth. And even if you don't come at it from a spiritual, from a perspective, just from our well-being and the ease with which we are in the world. So the first truth is dukkha. Dukkha is a hard word to define. It's often translated as suffering. It's one of the three marks of existence. It's the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha. And how it's put is birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what one wants is dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. So that's pretty much the list. Not getting what you want, getting too much of what you don't want, being separated from what you want. So it's you know, aging, of course, we experience some suffering with aging as well. And they talk about three kinds of dukkha, and I think it's important, without getting into too much detail on this, that there's dukkha, which is just that general pain that arises because we're human, right? The body ages, we get aches if we sit still, and maybe you noticed, did anybody notice that? A few people might have had an ache or two. And I can talk some more if you'd like about how to relate to those aches. See a few heads nodding, not too many. Okay. So that's just that inevitable pain that's arising. And you know what? If you can just that realization that being human involves some suffering. It's part of the human experience. You experience joy and wonderful pleasantness, but you also have the experience of grief and unpleasantness. So it's just that realization can really shift how we relate to the world. It seems when you hear it, it might seem obvious, but we don't often live with that, like deeply knowing that. Something crappy happens, and it's like, whoa, wow, surprised. Why did that happen? Well, the saying goes, shit happens. So we're not surprised when things don't go the way we thought they would go. Best laid plans, so to speak. When my wife retired, we went through this period where we were traveling a lot. She had all this kind of list of places she always wanted to go, so we thought, well, let's go visit them. And traveling's an interesting, because you have all these plans, right? And it's supposed to go here and here and here. And of course, the universe doesn't, you know, always just cooperate nice and neatly with the way things are supposed to go. Lots of causes and conditions come together, and it's a real practice in letting go. And what I found, the joy that I found in what you might call a difficulty, often were some of the most interesting experiences that we had. When things didn't work out the way we planned, so some spontaneous other thing happened, which wouldn't have happened if things had worked out the way. Some of those were the most joyous and interesting experiences, where you're kind of stranded and some local ends up helping you and then taking you home for dinner, and you meet his mother, and this stuff like that that wouldn't happen if the bus actually came. looking at the possibilities even in the difficulties, something that I learned from that. So then we also have two other types of dukkha: viparinama dukkha and sankhara dukkha. Viparinama dukkha is the suffering that results from change. So we see something pleasant and we want it to stick around. Of course, since things change, it doesn't always stay the way we want it to. So there's a sense of suffering from that. So it's that notion of change, and it's the idea of where suffering can come from, even pleasant, because of the way we cling to it, or we over-embellish it, and it doesn't meet our imagined criteria as well. Relationships can be like that, the perfect relationship. Oh, it's not perfect after all, or he's not perfect after all. So that can cause suffering as well. And sankhara dukkha, this is the one that we really explore the most in a retreat like this, and that's the dukkha that comes from our mental formations, in other words, stories. That layering over of the on top of the experience, the story, the why me story, or the you've seen these stories and how they can proliferate the emotional content, the anxiety or whatever it might be that's arising. We had some examples in our small groups of anxiety arising, and then the story about, oh, how this is going to go on and there's nothing I can do about it, and then of course more anxiety, and then more layering on of story. So this is the key part of dukkha, that the sankhara dukkha, and it has its origins in tanha, or craving, because it's a craving to want things to be other than they are, and that creates the suffering. Things are as they are. If we crave for them to be different than they are, then we inevitably suffer. So it's the practice is to be with what is, has already arisen, with a sense of acceptance, with non-judgment. I'm going to read a little I guess you'd call it a poem. Or no, it's not a poem. I'm going to read this first. It's from the book Buddhism Plain and Simple by Steve Hagen. It's called 83 Problems. It's a story called 83 Problems. There's an old story about a man who came to see the Buddha because he heard that the Buddha was a great teacher. Like all of us, he had some problems in life, and he thought the Buddha might be able to help him straighten them out. He told the Buddha that he was a farmer. "I like farming," he said, "but sometimes it doesn't rain enough and the crops fail. Last year we nearly starved. And sometimes it rains too much, so my yields aren't what I'd like them to be." The Buddha patiently listened to the man. "I'm married too," said the man. "She's a good wife. I love her. But sometimes she nags me too much, and sometimes I get tired of her." The Buddha listened quietly. "I have kids," said the man. "Good kids too, but sometimes they don't show me enough respect, and sometimes..." On and on and on and on. The man went on like this, laying out all his difficulties and worries. Finally, he wound down and waited for the Buddha to say the words that would put everything right for him. Instead, the Buddha said, "I can't help you." "What do you mean?" said the astonished man. "Everybody's got problems," said the Buddha. "In fact, we've all got 83 problems, each one of us. 83 problems, and there's nothing you can do about it. If you work really hard on one of them, maybe you can fix it. But if you do, another one just pop right up in its place. For example, you're going to lose your loved ones eventually, and you're going to die someday. Now there's a problem, and there's nothing you or I or anyone else can do about it." The man became furious. "I thought you were a great teacher," he shouted. "I thought you could help me. What good is your teaching then?" The Buddha said, "Well, maybe it will help. I can help you with your 84th problem." "The 84th problem," said the man. "What's the 84th problem?" The Buddha said, "That you want to not have any problems." That's, for me, the first noble truth right there. It's so accepting that we all have problems, and there's it's part of being human, and really looking at how we relate to those problems. For example, knee pain or back pain arising when you're meditating. Knee pain feels like this, being with the sensation. Spending some time with the sensation, breathing with the sensation. I mean, it's discomfort, right? I'm not saying you have this overwhelming pain. And I mean, even pain, you can sit with it, but I'm especially talking about discomfort. Sitting with it, feeling the suchness of it. This is what it feels like. Noticing if a story arises about it, noticing thoughts, emotions that are arising with it, and just breathing and noticing if it stays or fades. Maybe it keeps coming back every once in a while. I pulled a muscle in my side working out that boat pose we did, only you get a 25-pound weight and you go like this from side to side. I did it too much, and so there's like a pulled muscle here. So when I was sitting, the last sitting, it just poke its head out, go, "Hi, I'm here." Well, there's that pulled muscle. There it is. This is how it feels being with it. And then eventually it would drop out of awareness. It seemed like the longer the sit went, the closer the time frame it would come back. "Oh, here I am again." "Oh, there you are." Okay. So give some attention, bring awareness to it. Fade a little bit, shift, just sort of notice what the sensations felt like, where they were and what exactly they were. Just being with them. And at one point I just felt like, well, if I shift, this might ease things a little bit. I've investigated this for pretty much the entire meditation. So I shifted, and that was just what arose for me after I'd investigated it and been with it for a while, was to shift. And it did help a little bit. It came back, even with the shift, so that I thought, well, shifting, so I'm just going to have to be with it. So we're acknowledging and we're really practicing being with it in a new way. I mentioned this in the small group, and we're oftentimes not that much different than my dog Rocky. So my dog Rocky, when he gets an itch or a little bit of discomfort, it's like you just, you know, you see a dog. I mean, they're just reacting. They're not. There's no cognitive ability to do anything else but just react to discomfort. And I was equating that to a room full of academics, watching paper, listening to lectures, papers from other academics. And it really struck me. They were so in their heads. They were completely unconscious of their bodies and movement. Everything move around, shift, and this and that. And then after so much time, that people would actually get up. All of a sudden, a lot of people have to go to the bathroom or get a drink of something. So there's just this then distracting. So there's this kind of unconscious autopilot mode. So what we're doing with the practice is we're being aware of all that discomfort and changing our relationship to it, to allowing rather than constantly trying to get rid of it or distract ourselves from it. Suzuki Roshi, one of my favorite teachers. The person who can freely acknowledge that life is full of difficulties can be free because they are acknowledging the nature of life, that it can't be much else. So suffering's not a problem or a mistake. It's part of being human. That's the first noble truth. And once you, and you don't really know what's going to happen. The phrase that Suzuki Roshi used was beginner's mind. You just don't know, or don't know mind, as it's sometimes called. Once you know dukkha, you just kind of live with the don't know mind. You don't know when a difficulty is going to arise or a pleasant experience is going to arise. Now, there's so much I could say here about how to relate to difficulties and what letting go is. Letting go is not throwing down, so we have to watch about whether we turn letting go into aversion. Letting go is more of a allowing and holding, or letting be, you could say. Letting things be. Okay. And in letting things be, there's a space that arises. Viktor Frankl's quote somewhere here. I just printed it, so I know it's here. One of my favorite teaching quotes. It's Viktor Frankl. He's an Austrian psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor, and he's got many books on out on different topics. This quote's from him. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and freedom. A very simple three sentences, but very deep. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. If we're just reacting automatically, there's no space. It's just it's just all happening unconsciously, and our choices are very limited because we're reacting. When there's a space, and it could just be one breath, other options can emerge in that space. That's the way, you know, he says, you know, your power to choose a response. But really what I see is other options, space for other options to emerge that wouldn't have emerged without that space, which gives you all kinds of freedom and how to proceed. I see this so much in my life where this little pause, you know, especially in communications with other people, difficult communications in particular, where there's a difficult communication and the reaction might be to do a particular thing, allow a pause, and these options then emerge for other things to be said, which can lead to more or to less conflict or to more understanding, as opposed to, you know, a battle between two people. So this is very important, and when we're practicing this here, we're training that habit of allowing that space, of training the habit of being with difficulties rather than reacting to them, but kind of unconsciously. Rather than unconscious reaction, we have an opportunity for a pause and a mindfully mediated response. And so we're training that as we sit. Like I said, we're doing a whole lot of nothing, but we're really trained by being with what's arising. We're training, we're creating new habits. And not only new habits, we're changing the structure of our brain. My wife said there's this online symposium on neurology in the brain and meditation, and my wife's taking this, and she was sending me messages. Oh, you got to tell them this. You got to tell them this. And you know, she said, you got to tell them this line. So I wrote it down. Where attention goes, neural firing flows. So it's kind of this notion of you're creating these new neural pathways. You're actually restructuring your brain. And that's what they're the sort of the latest science is exploring, how the brain changes from meditation. So it is changing in substantial ways. I won't go into too much detail on that. So it's how we respond. Oh, I'm still on the first noble truth. Okay, I better move along. But as I said, if you just understand the first noble truth, it will significantly transform how you relate to life, to the world. You won't be surprised when a difficulty happens. Oh, there it is. That's part of life. It's supposed to happen. You don't have control over it. It just happens. It happens to everybody. The second noble truth is, well, what's the cause of our suffering then? Like the sankhara dukkha, that extra dukkha. So we all have the pain. The Buddha would talk about two arrows. The first arrow is the pain that we that's part of being human, that we is an unavoidable. The second arrow, which is optional, is shot in exactly the same spot and causes extra suffering. I've heard, you know, of all the suffering that we experience, 10% of it is the dukkha that's unavoidable, and 90% of it is the stuff we create for ourselves, because, you know, and due to how we relate to the 10%. So if you can get rid of that 90%, you can just kind of just be with the by being with the 10% in a different way. That's the suffering and the end of suffering. So craving, the mind craves for things to be other than they are. And that's when suffering arises. So things are a particular way. The Buddha always liked to talk about his... the Dharma can be understood through the Four Noble Truths or through what's called dependent origination. And I would love to give a retreat on dependent origination. It's a such a useful framework. Buddha had all these different ways of accessing kind of the same truth, but did all these different ways depending on who he was talking to. And dependent origination is a really interesting and helpful way, but doesn't sound exciting, does it? How many people would come to a retreat called Exploring Dependent Origination? One hand almost went up, but she was scratching her head. maybe if the, I'll have to call it something else, but just teach that anyway. But it's so interesting. I mean, look at how you got here to this retreat. See if you can think back to what events occurred, what factors led to you being here. See if you can think of the factors that arose that brought you here. You might even be able to trace it back to like an original factor. Now think about each one of those factors, all the factors that came together for that to happen. Just see what I'm talking, what I mean? Just even that root factor, but there's many factors that came together. But each one of those has a whole variety of factors that had to occur for that to arise. And then each one of those had a whole bunch of factors that had to arise for each one of those. And you can just see it expands exponentially to the point where the universe basically brought you here. Life brought you here. Because all the factors are just so multiple that it's the entirety of life that brought you. And that's how everything arises. Completely codependent on everything else. Everything it's inseparable from everything else because everything that's arising is dependent. If you bring it back to all the causal factors, it's the universe, total interconnection. So it's this cause of chain, this cause and effect that we really need to understand, and that's where craving arises from. Within that chain of cause and effect. So your entire experience can be summed up by the six senses. So you have, let's take sound, you have a sense organ, which is your ear, and if it's functional, it will receive sounds, which then are transmitted to your brain. You need the sound itself. So you need to have an actual sound, and you need to be aware of the sound. So there needs to be consciousness of the sound. So you could have sounds occurring, and you can have the sense organ, but if there isn't consciousness, it didn't occur for you. It's not part of your experience. So you need all three, sense organ, sense object, and sense consciousness. All three have to come together for it to be a part of your experience. So that's basically your experience. It's whether it's a taste, a touch, a sound, and then adding thought to that, mind and thought, and then awareness. So that's just constant. And when those three come together, you have what's called contact. So it's your entire experience is that this contact of these three things coming together, and what arises from that is either an automatic reaction of pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant, which we've translated as being neutral. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Everything. Some of it's very automatic. Some of it needs a perceptual overlay. You need a perception. So a piece of music would come on. Some people's perception would be, ooh, I don't like this. This is terrible music. Another person's perception is, oh, I love this music. So our perceptions determine and cause whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then what arises, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, grasping for the pleasant, pushing away the unpleasant, indifferent to the neutral. And then clinging. Seeing that your happiness, illusionary self's happiness, is dependent on getting more of the pleasant and keeping away the unpleasant. And that's really what clinging is. And this is where the suffering comes in. All the other stuff just happens, cause and effect, dependent origination operating, your life unfolding, and then we insert the clinging, wanting things to be other than they are, with the idea that this illusionary self that you're somehow in control of, its happiness is dependent on you being able to control that, creates suffering. So if you actually think you have control, like if you're not, this is what dependent origination kind of puts aside, the whole notion that you're somehow, you know, got the joystick and you're guiding everything. If you actually think that you're in control, then if you suffer, it's your fault. You should have controlled it better. If you actually think you have control, then of course there's blame that's occurring, because yeah, I should have. So it's that notion that we're somehow independent and we can control all the factors. We can control the universe. And limit our suffering and therefore be happy, that causes us to suffer. So if we can kind of let go of that. That's a hard thing to hear. It's your fault, but in a way, it's true. So that's the second noble truth. So, can you watch a desire arise and just be with it without it causing suffering? You're seeing desire, what causes suffering, but it's the clinging to the desire. It's that clingy mind state that causes the suffering. Desires will arise, preferences will arise. It is their clingy mind state. When I did my yoga training, I was in India, and it was a tantric. What you actually practiced this afternoon was tantric yoga, which is quite different. You might not know what the differences are, but it was tantric yoga, which is a rare thing to get in North America. The only place you can get trained in it is India. And so we were at this, and tantra is all about your relationship to the pleasurable, not the discomfort side of it. It's the, which always fascinated me, how that subtle suffering that happens in how we relate to pleasure. And of course in the West, because sex is a pleasurable activity, it's a very small part of tantric practice, but in the West, it's kind of almost equivalent. Sex. We picked up on that bit and kind of forgot about the other 99.99% of the practices. So I was there for several months, and one of the things we did that was interesting was a chocolate cake practice. So we were in an ashram, vegetarian, lots of lentils, very healthy food, but you know, the desire comes up every once in a while for something familiar, right? And I like chocolate. Like, it's just chocolate's awesome. And so there wasn't any chocolate. There wasn't any dessert at all, actually. And he kind of knew this, right, having been exposed to enough Westerners. So we'd have this chocolate cake practice. And there was a town that was 45 minutes to an hour away that had a little cafe that had chocolate cake. But you had to walk across a lava rock. I don't know if you know what lava, it's like pointy rocks. It's molten that's solidified, all kind of pointy. So you have to wear shoes and walk very carefully. It's a treacherous and long walk. And we'd be thinking, and he'd say, we're going for chocolate cake. So I start salivating right away. I notice the desire arising. And then we'd walk. And half the time, they never had chocolate cake. And you got to know that. So you started to go, okay. The first time, it's you get there and there's no chocolate cake. Suffering. All that way. So you just relate to this, and then you start to get the idea that there's about a 50-50 chance they're going to have chocolate cake. So you kind of get to, okay, I'm going to walk this. I'm going to be equanimous with the fact that there might not be chocolate cake. And when you get there and you get the chocolate, oh, there's chocolate cake. So there's like, you know, the sense of desire fulfilled. And you take a bite, oh, so, and then the second bite, yeah, it's chocolate cake. Yeah. And it didn't meet, because you had like an hour or two build up the image of how wonderful this is going to be, like the biggest thing ever. You get there and it's, you know, it's chocolate cake, right? So there's a little hint of suffering even in that. And so we were just noticing all that. So we're noticing that side of it, which is more subtle, but nonetheless a suffering arising. And we also notice what the side of it that we're resisting. And how what we resist persists and proliferates. And when we allow both sides of the equation. We just allow the pleasant and the unpleasant. So we can allow the pleasant. We can enjoy the pleasant. I started to realize I can enjoy the company as I'm walking. I don't have to just be salivating and clinging. I can enjoy the company, enjoy the walk to the chuck. And so the practice really deepened in that way, just enjoying the moments, the present moment, rather than the outcome, anticipating the outcome. And that's what the clingy mind is. The clingy mind's all about the outcome. I'm really looking for that outcome. Caught in desire. So what the Tao Te Ching, there's a quote, free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you see only the manifestation. So you're really opening yourselves to the mystery of life when you let go of desire. And Ajahn Sumedho, a wonderful teacher, letting go is leaving things as they are. Just being with things as they are is the practice. So it's this attachment to the outcome. So you don't diminish your values or your aspirations or your commitment to goals by letting go of grasping. You're letting go of attachment to the outcome. That's key. That attachment actually gets in the way of getting to the goal. This is coming into business magazines and I just took a teacher training on, it's called MPEAK, Mindful Performance Enhancement Awareness and Knowledge, and it was used with the American Olympic team. It's coming out of the University of California, San Diego campus, Center for Mindfulness. And so I was, you know, and I'm also a dragon boater, so I was looking at how to apply this to, it's for athletes, how to apply this, and it had paddlers who were so focused. So there's 20 paddlers in a dragon boat. So you're paddling together, and it's a synchronicity, and you're working as one. You're not like, you know, doing it yourself. But we had paddlers who were focused on the outcome. They'd actually be focused on that finish line. And what happens is you start, okay, yeah, I can get us to the finish line, and you get out a stroke, And so it was really a process of saying, okay, don't be looking at the finish line. Be in the moment of the activity. Just be present with the flow of the boat and the activity with the present moment. And saw a shift in how people could sort of take their, or checking to see where other boats are. Like, as an individual, one out of 20, you're going to actually make a difference. The only way is for the whole boat to come up together and feel it together. So that's this notion of being the clingy mind, clinging to the outcome, letting go, just relaxing around the outcome. So we want to win the race, right? We're a competitive team. It's not a recreational team. These are paddlers that are the best paddlers recruited from the region, and we want to beat Montreal, we want to beat Toronto, and then we went to Worlds, and we wanted to beat every other country. But it wasn't going to happen if we were just always clinging to the outcome. So there's still a goal, but it's how we engage in the activity that shifts how we perform. And they had some beneficial results with the Olympic team. They did some brain scans as well and showed some different neurological effects on the athletes. The ability to absorb failure. So when something doesn't go your way, the ability to go, okay, I'm learning from this and moving on. And as opposed to sort of letting it pull you down. So This is an interesting area. Remembering that we're not suppressing desire, so we're not numbing ourselves out or not caring. It's not that. It's non-clinging that we're looking to. Looking at that clingy mind. So how do you know whether you're abandoning clinging or whether you're suppressing it? So you don't want to substitute attachment to abandonment. for attachment to desire, right? So you really have to be careful with that. One way is, do you feel a sense of contraction or a sense of opening? If there's a sense of opening and spaciousness, then you're practicing non-clinging more likely. If there's still a contraction and an anxiety arising, then it's likely you're trying to suppress or deny what's arising. Do you feel like something new is unfolding, or do you feel like it's the same old pattern? That's a really interesting one for me. This feels new. It feels light. This is what non-clinging feels like. Another thing, I'm suppressing something here. I'm denying something. I feel stuck in an old pattern. Do you feel the situation of suffering is worse, or does it feel like it's dissolving somewhat? It's another indicator, whether it's non-clinging. So this is a key part of stress reduction. You can see how it fits together, right? Stress being suffering. A certain amount of stress is inevitable in our lives. Like I said at the very beginning, I'm not going to get rid of your stress. But we can look at how we relate to that stress, shift how we relate to the stress, then shift how we relate to the joys as well. Works both sides of the of it. So the third noble truth is realizing the cessation of suffering. So this is the mind that is with whatever it's with whatever arises. And isn't disturbed by it. You live from the place of knowing and direct experience. And you live with this sense of not knowing. You don't know what's going to happen next. So that's part of the living from the big mystery. You never know what's going to happen. So if we come with the sense of always knowing, we can't be open to the present moment. That's the famous Zen story of the Buddhist scholar who goes in to talk to the Zen teacher, and the Zen teacher starts so it's a Buddhist scholar. He starts pouring his tea, and he just keeps pouring and pouring, and the cup's overflowing. And the Buddhist scholar says, "What are you doing? My cup's full, and it's just overflowing all over the table." And the monk says, "So it is with your mind. How can I teach you when it is so overflowing with all that you know?" Mm-hmm. It's an invitation to kind of empty. I used to have a thing on my door at the university that said empty mind. Students used to wonder what that meant. A professor with an empty mind, just what we need. But it elicited some interesting conversations. So this remembering the don't know mind is so key. Remembering the beginner's mind, coming with that freshness to our experience because we don't know what's going to happen next. Being present with the present moment experience and being open to what might happen next. This, I talk about the power of mindfulness. It seems so simple, right? We're just being aware of what's arising in the present moment. Not wanting it to be any different than it is. Then what's already arisen. Doesn't mean what we do next, of course, because of dependent origination, cause and effect, which was what karma, what we do next has ripple effects out into the world in unknown ways. We kind of see what happens directly, but then just the ripple effects of what we do next. So that present moment stance allows all these options for us to then go into what happens next. So that's such amazing transformation in a way to be in relation to the world. Ramana Maharishi said, there is no greater mystery than this. That which we keep seeking, reality, though in fact we are reality. So we may be grasping for some, big aha that's going to, be enlightenment or something, and then we'll be all good. And we can grasp for that, right? But really, the mystery, you are that. You're inseparable from the mystery, from the reality. So what you're seeking is right here. It can be seen right here. There's a couple quotes here. I love this. What am I doing? Yeah. Albert Einstein. He's got some wonderful quotes. I remember many, many years ago I Googled, is Albert Einstein a Buddhist? Well, it wasn't that many years ago if it was Googling, but I Googled, is Albert Einstein a Buddhist? Because the things you read about him is like, he's so... And apparently he wasn't. He was just, if you look at quantum, the way physics relates to the world, there's some similarities. A human being is part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. Wow. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our desires and to affection to a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature. Yeah, it's So you get Dharma quotes from a guy who wasn't a Dharma teacher, just from what he saw. So the optical delusion of consciousness, this seeing ourselves as separate, is an optical delusion of consciousness. And the sense that we are, you know, when the Buddha talked about anatta or not self, that's what he was pointing to, this delusion, this optical delusion that we see ourselves as separate. And the suffering that comes about from not realizing that we're actually interconnected. So we're constantly trying to make this interconnected interbeing happy by isolating it. We're trying to isolate it from the causes and conditions that we don't want. It's a recipe for suffering. So it's that simple. As my Dragon Boat coach would say, don't do it. When we do something wrong, don't do it. Let it go. Let go of that optical delusion that's kind of a prison for us. A kind of prison. That's why the Buddha used that word freedom. Liberation. It's freedom from the entanglements and the shackles of that limited self-view. That kind of small me, I, clingy view to the more expansive view of interbeing or interconnectedness. And from that flows a natural compassion. I suffer, you suffer, you suffer. We all have suffering as part of our lives. So we have compassion for ourselves, for the humanity, and for the suffering of others. So love kind of naturally springs from that. From that knowing that you wouldn't hurt another person just like you wouldn't hurt your arm. Buddha used the image of a mother with a newborn infant. That sense of love that we have for all beings. Bring that sense of love and connection. And bring that sense of love and connection to yourselves. In your own practice as well. Acceptance. This trance of unworthiness is more than an impediment to our practice. It creates so much unease in the way that we live in the world. We all feel it, and in many cases think that we're the only ones that feel it to a great extent. I don't feel that not good enough. I need to fix some things. Then I'll be okay. Just if I'm a little more caring, a little more generous, read a couple more self-improvement books, then I'll be okay. Okay, just you're dependently arisen, so we're all okay. We all just are. So just bring that sense of self-love to your practice. I was astonished, and I'll end with this story. I was at a Dharma teacher training retreat. So it was all Dharma teachers. This was my first experience at one of these retreats. And everybody else in the room were like, you know, big deals. These were big-time teachers. American, well-known. And we're going around the room talking about what was coming up for us after we did this particular exercise. And what came up for me was like, I shouldn't be here. I'm not good enough for this. These guys are way beyond me. And it was a real sense of lack was coming up for me. And I thought, well, I should share my truth. I mean, that's what we're here for, is to be open and share our truth. But it was really difficult. I could feel it kind of constricting, and there was fear that if I say this, well, then people look down on me even more. Maybe, or should I pretend like I should say something really smart, and then they'll actually love me. So I was kind of toying with the really smart option or the speak my truth option. I thought, well, the Dharma says speak the truth. Damn. So I'll go with. So luckily I didn't go first, because I was still, this was all coming up. But other people went, and sort of the three most famous teachers happened to be, and what was coming up with this for them was a sense of not being good enough, a real sense of lack, like I don't have what it takes to offer these teachings and to hold people in this way. And I'm just like, so it came, I was, and every single person in that room said in so many words the same thing. And it was an amazing for me to experience that, and to just see this trance of unworthiness, how deeply it can be ingrained in us. And of course, the practice of acknowledging it, of that arising, is what it's all about. I mean, we're all practicing that acknowledging. That's what came up. That's what the question was. What came up after this? So that's what the acknowledging of it just allows it to just be something that arises. It doesn't need to be believed and bought into and then a story and so on and so forth. So just that recognition really opened my heart to a kind of the shared. The interconnection and shared humanity of us all. So, onward we go with our practice. I think I'm going to also open up the opportunity for you to write down some questions over the next day of practice, like tonight and then into tomorrow. So just write them down and we'll leave them on the table. Practice questions. What's coming up for you? Any practice questions. So that way, I'm not saying I'll be able to, depending on how many I get, that I'll be able to answer them all in great detail, but it'll help me sort of frame my talk such that it's addressing what's going on with you folks. Sometimes I feel like I'm sort of just putting things out there, and hopefully it's relevant to a few people here and there. So we'll shift on into some walking meditation and then a sitting practice.